papers. We handed out two pages, front and back. Just wanted to start out by reading that opening paragraph on the page titled TLC Leadership Meeting 10-2-2012. We have a mission, and we're committed to fulfilling it. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people in our area are still in need of Jesus. They're suffering, crying, and dying all around us. The changes we make, the sacrifices we all make, the discomfort and the chaos we experience will be worth it. We will continue learning, innovating, reaching out, obeying, creating, and continue growing. We will make mistakes. We will fail at times, but we will learn and keep moving forward. We will not quit. We will not let Satan win. We will not allow our generation here in our location to miss out on Jesus, on church, nor heaven. That is my commitment to you, to our area, and to God. I'm convinced it's our commitment as leaders at the Life Center as well. So that's why we do leadership training. That's why we do all the other hard things that we do and inconvenient things that we do, because we have a mission and we're committed to fulfilling it. So hopefully a paragraph like that can help us get through our difficult days, go to the meetings we don't want to go to, do the things we don't necessarily want to do, because we have a mission and we're committed to fulfilling it. On the second page I handed out is something you've seen before already, that TLC improvement ideas for the fall. And I just wanted you to have it again. I wanted you to look at it and review it, go over it. Some of those things have been accomplished already. Some of them haven't been accomplished already. On the back of that are some timelines that we have set back in August. And we've missed a few of those timelines already, but we're just going to pick them up and keep working on them. Maybe a timeline we've missed is the foyer decor update. We haven't got the decor updated in the foyer yet. Stage decor, we've got that updated. You like it? Yeah. just kidding. seeker greeters, I don't think we've got that accomplished yet, have we? I think our people that go out in the parking lot and, yeah, heat seekers, and they just go out and meet people in the parking lot and greet them real generously and help them carry stuff in or whatever we need to do, help them park or answer whatever, just they're out there in the parking lot helping. Save back seat for visitors. I don't think we've done that yet, but we need to get our chains up, our reserve signs up, and reserve the back four or five rows. That'll make a few people upset again, you know, that are comfortable back there, but we really need to do that. That helps a lot when we do it, especially when we have a middle row like this. It really helps in this kind of a seating arrangement. Yeah, we have them available. We just don't set them up yet. Oh, are you? Okay. Both of them? So we're talking about those chains are being used in the nursery right now. The chains here. We're chaining kids up in the nursery. It's our new check-in program. They're plastic, yeah. We can work on that and order some more if we need to. We do have a couple reserve signs, caution tape. Put some cobwebs. It's Halloween. We put some cobwebs up there. So, yeah, we can get more of those. We can discuss that. We don't have a lot of time for discussion today if we're going to get this knocked out in an hour because this is not a planning meeting. Information booth hasn't happened yet, and the newsletter was supposed to happen on the 23rd, and that'll be pushed back a couple weeks. So that's that page. I noticed the email that I sent out back in Wednesday the 29th, I sent out to everybody with this updated sheet. We had getting something on our Connect cards to discover people's preferred method of communication. That's another thing we haven't done yet, but we'll get that going this week and try to help our communication in the church be better. So if you have any more ideas or want to talk about that, you can stay afterwards tonight. I'd be glad to talk about any of those things. People that just want to hang around, and or we can email me, call me on the phone, set up a private meeting, whatever, and we can talk about all of that and work on those. So back to the TLC leadership meeting 10-12. We've handled the first two bullet points there. We're looking at the third bullet point now. A timely resource today is this book called Cracking Your Church's Culture Code by Samuel Chand. And this was something that was recommended to the district board in the Pacific Northwest by our Bishop Duane. And so I got on Amazon and ordered it as soon as he recommended it. And it was almost waiting for me when I got home. It was like a day later it shows up. Such a timely book and right where we're at. A lot of things we've been talking about, a lot of things that I need to change and improve. And so I read it, was convicted, inspired, and grateful for its arrival in my life. I would like you guys to all read it. I had an extra one, but I already gave it away to my most favorite people on staff. Kelsey was teasing me about it. I always offer it to my associates first because they're poor and need help. No, just kidding. Anyway, I had one, and I've already given that out today, but you can get it. It's like $15 on Amazon. Kindle's 13 or something. And I encourage you to please get it and read it. And we're going to highlight some of it today. But this is the book I think that we'll be talking about for the next few months. I would like to have deep discussions about the things that are in the book. They've designed a specific survey for us to go along with what is our church culture, help us discover it. And as soon as we find what our culture is, then we can start applying the points in the book, the teaching points, to improve that. Just reading it, I'm already going up. We're not going to do good there. I'm not going to do good there. I'm not going to do good there. I think we did good there. I think we'll do okay there. So it'll be interesting. So you all will be receiving that in an email, and then you'll have to take it online. So of course, you might have to have Jan help you, and Johnny will have to have Karen help him, and some of those folks. Also, we need somebody to take a roll today, too, of who's here, so we can get information out to those that aren't. If everybody signs up on that, that'll be great. So please read it. If you want help purchasing it, let me know, and we'll help you do that. We'll figure out a way to help you do that. If we can improve our culture, then we'll have a church and a staff and a leadership team that's much more supporting, fulfilling, enjoyable, accountable in the good way of accountable, not in the bad way of accountable, and fruitful. So when I read it, I know I have to make major changes personally to accomplish this needed change. Together, we'll have to make some shifts in our thinking and our talking and our actions. And then here's some ideas from the book. Culture, not vision or strategy, is the most powerful factor in any organization. Culture eats strategy for lunch. When I read that, I'm just going, that is a powerful statement for somebody like me who's a strategist, who's a administrative personality. Culture eats strategy for lunch. And I'm always interested in lunch, so my ears perked up when I heard that. That was a joke. Sorry. Well, thank you. Very few churches have taken the necessary steps to assess, correct, and change their culture. Organization culture is the personality of the church. It includes tangibles and intangibles. The way people look, behave, the look of the facility, the posters on the wall, etc., are the tangibles. The intangibles are harder to define, but they include things like beliefs, assumptions, how success is celebrated, how problems are addressed, and the manifestations of trust and respect. Vision and strategy usually focus on products, services, and outcomes, but culture is about the people, the most valuable asset in the organization. And so if we can make some of these changes that I think we're going to need to make when we take our survey and we get back the results of that, I just see morale around here skyrocketing. I see stickiness, people that come into the church staying and loving it. I think our stickiness will increase a bunch. I think all of our pulses will go down about 10 beats a minute. And our cholesterol might lower a little too. our stress levels will lower. We'll be much more supportive, supported, encouraged, inspired if we can make these shifts. Sometimes I wonder, how come we're not reaching our mission quicker? How come we're not accomplishing things quicker? And a lot of conversations I've had recently comes back to our culture. It comes back to me being more of a strategist and more task-oriented and more administrative and not as people-friendly, people-oriented. And the reason I administrate and strategize is because I'm so people-oriented, but it doesn't always come out that way. And it isn't always visible, and it isn't always recognized. So there's a lot of good changes that I can make to encourage that and push that along. So vision and strategy focuses on product, services, and outcomes, but culture is about the people, the most valuable asset in the organization. The shape of an organization's culture begins at the top level. The leader's integrity, competence, and care for the staff members create the environment where people excel. When I read that, I'm going, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Integrity, I think I got a lot of that. I think I have some competence. Care for the staff, that may not be very high on the scale that I need to improve. So I definitely saw that as something I can improve big time. Senior pastors are in a unique position to shape the culture of their teams and their church, but they don't do it alone. They need the support, wisdom, and commitment from every person on the team. So I definitely can't do this on my own. That's one reason I wanted you all to read the book, and I want us all to discuss the book and underline it. And you know, I wrote little notes to myself in the margins of, Kelly, never do this again, and Kelly, improve this, and wow, I hate that point. And I wrote all sorts of notes to myself in the margin. I wrote a woo-hoo, I think, a couple times, but I think he actually hit one of my soapboxes. You know, I go, woo-hoo, somebody agrees with me, yay. The next point is toxic culture is like carbon monoxide. You don't see it or smell it, but you wake up dead. I thought that was an interesting phrase, you wake up dead. Yeah. But I get his point. A toxic environment is sometimes hard to define and discern. That's the reason I'm really excited about this book and the survey that they're creating for us. And then they'll evaluate it and send us the results. And it's all free. It's just something they did for buying the book and working through the book. So it will help us recognize some of those things we don't see or smell, but we wake up dead from. A positive culture will act as an accelerant to your vision. The second title for the book is Seven Keys to Unleashing Vision and Inspiration. And so when you're reading the book, you're going, sometimes you have the right visions, you have the right mission, you have the right strategies, you have the right commitment level, but if you don't have the right culture, then your vision, your mission, your inspiration is chained up like we do the kids in the nursery. We got them all chained up and they can't get out, you know, or free. But these are seven keys to unleashing vision and inspiration. Five kinds of culture are inspiring, accepting, stagnant, discouraging, and toxic. And I wanted to read about the inspiring one because that's where we want to go. This is what we want to create. I'm not sure where we're going to end up on the evaluation. Depends on what kind of mood we're all in when we take it, what time of day we take it, and what day of the week, and maybe all of that stuff. I don't know where we'll all end up. But wherever we end up on the evaluation, we might be stagnant or discouraged. I hope we're not toxic. I'd love it if we were accepting. If they were there, I'd go for that one. But I really want us to go to inspiring. So here's some characteristics of inspiring cultures. The leaders of these organizations give clear direction, but they aren't authoritarian. They value the input of every person. Authority is decentralized. Leaders cultivate an atmosphere of trust and respect. People throughout the organization believe that what they do each day really matters to themselves, their teams, the church, or nonprofit, and to their constituents. They come to work each day with a compelling sense of purpose, a sense that they are involved in a cause much bigger than themselves. The next one is, these organizations have high but realistic expectations. They set high goals, train people, give them the resources they need, stay connected throughout the process, and encourage them to succeed. The next one, creativity is rewarded, and failures are viewed as stepping stones of growth. In fact, failure is seen as an essential part of the process of innovation, not as a fatal flaw. Next one, there are few, if any, turf battles, so communication flows up and down the organizational chart and between departments. Next one, top leaders retrain, or replace ministry leaders who can't provide positive work environment for their teams. Next one, there's a powerful synergy between relationships and organizational goals. That's something that we can definitely improve. The organization invests significantly and systematically in creating and building a healthy culture. Next one, leaders regularly celebrate success throughout the organization. They even celebrate those who leave and find success elsewhere. The last one is, these organizations are a magnet for job applicants. They have their pick of the best and the brightest. We're not really looking for job applicants, but we are looking to attract people to God, to the church, to the kingdom, and train them, make their life better, encourage them, create a great culture for them to go home and create a great culture in their home with one another, on their jobs, in their businesses. We're trying to create some stickiness for sure. So those are some things about the inspiring culture that we want to create, make sure that we get there. The author makes statements, people don't thrive in confusion. Then he has an entire chapter on the catalyst of chaos. I thought that was an interesting factoid when I was reading through it. Because sometimes around here we have confusion, and right now we have chaos around here. We're making changes, and we haven't communicated the changes well, and not everybody's sure of what we're doing or why we're doing it, and so we're having some confusion and some chaos. So he said people don't thrive in confusion. Then he wrote an entire chapter on the catalyst of chaos, and he was pro-chaos. So it made me feel a little better when I got to that chapter. That was like four chapters later, though. It took me four chapters to start feeling better. We need to work hard on clarity. So how do you make chaos a catalyst instead of just have confusion that de-energizes people and hurts their motivation? Work hard on clarity, communication, and follow-through, but also know that change and transition creates chaos, and that will be pretty much a constant in a growing church. So we've talked about that a lot, but when it happens, we still don't like it. When we're involved in the chaos, and when the chaos is touching something that we prefer a different way, or something that we are uncomfortable with, or something that we wish was different, or when it touches us, we're not happy with the chaos, and so that's natural. But if we can get used to the fact that a growing church will always be changing, we'll always be changing. We're making a lot of changes right now, very intentionally, for some very good reasonings, and a lot of times we don't always share all the reasonings. I don't know if we have to share all of them all the time, but we should share enough to where you're feeling confident of why we're doing it. There's a good reason. Hopefully someday we'll get to a point to where we trust each other enough to know there's a good reason and we're positive about the change, even though we're not liking it personally and how it's affecting us personally. Hopefully we can do that. Would love us to get to that point. I go through that in the district. Just went through it recently in the district this summer, and God actually had to really talk to me about what he was doing and why he was doing it in order for me to get comfortable with the changes that had occurred. And I wrote about that in a newsletter that we shipped out a few weeks ago. So I'm experiencing that myself on a whole other level there in another arena. So if we can work hard on clarity, communication, and follow-through, and know that change and transition does create chaos, and that it will pretty much be a constant in a growing church. The seven keys of culture are control. This is kind of the acronym there. Control, understanding, leadership, trust, unafraid, responsive, and execution. And that's not actually killing somebody. That's a different execution. That's actually getting the right outcome. I was listening to a football game the other day, and all the coach was talking about execution. If we would just execute, we could have had a better play. If we could have just execute, we would have had a better quarter, you know, and just doing the things you know you're supposed to be doing, the basics, and getting the good result. Vocabulary defines culture. When we get too busy to care for one another, trust erodes, defenses go up. Even though we're trying to reach every person on the planet, we need to slow down to show interest in each individual. And so this is a big concept. The first two-thirds of this book is really all about you need to create a culture where you're taking care of each other, trusting each other, supporting each other. You need to create that culture, because no matter what your strategies and vision and mission are, a team cannot sustain high expectations and sacrifice unless they have a culture that enables that. So when I'm reading the book, I'm going, so that's my problem right there. You know, I want more strategies, new things, change all this stuff. How come we're not at 300 yet? How come we're not building phase two yet? How come? We should be, I think. How come we're not? And then I just feel like the Lord gifted this book to us, to me, and said, if you'll create this culture, the mission, the vision will be unleashed and it'll happen much easier with a lower pulse rate and less cholesterol. So that'd be cool, huh? So vocabulary defines culture. When we get too busy to care for one another, trust erodes, defenses go down, or go up, I'm sorry. Even though we're trying to reach every person, I just read that, we need to slow down and show interest in each individual. And I have trouble even doing that, reading that, and then today, getting ready for this meeting, and trying to get ready for tomorrow night's meeting, and I got to have my sermon done by Thursday at midnight, and but yet I have a whole bunch of people stuff I need to do, too. It's challenging. It's really challenging. And I've got lots of other things I need to do. But I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna figure it out. To build a new culture, we first have to recognize and destroy the old one. Not destroy the person, but destroy the culture of suspicion and secret alliances. He talks a lot about that, several, maybe almost a half a chapter on that concept there. Change starts with me. Any person in an organization can be a positive change agent. So he says, yeah, the senior pastor in a church really does set the tone, and they need to set the tone, but you can set the tone in the department you lead. You can set the tone in the people that are your peers and that are around you. Even if the church is all messed up, there are churches that are messed up that have departments that are thriving because that departmental leader is setting a culture that enables that thing to thrive. And so anybody can do it, but we definitely want the senior pastor to do it. Change agents need to be positive, but they also need to be multidimensional. They must also possess the ability to ask penetrating questions to help the group discern God's will, find the best alignment of roles and goals, and develop the best plan for any challenge. And I just thought that's something we've tried to create, and I don't think we've been successful at it yet, but we want to create an environment where you can ask questions, to where you can get information, to where you can have a conversation with somebody and clear up misunderstandings. We want to create an environment to where, hey, I don't think I like this. I don't think I like that. Why are we doing that? Is that the best thing for us to do? And be able to do that in a positive way that's healthy versus a controversial way that drives wedges between people and departments. So asking those questions with the goal of helping the group discern God's will, finding the best alignment of roles and goals, and developing the best plan for any challenge. Those questions are designed to just get the best solutions and the best answers. Unhealthy teams never talk about the elephant in the room. The refusal to talk about the issue is a bigger deal than the issues themselves. Talk earlier, not later. And that's such a key thing. On the last third of this book are kind of shorter ideas that have to dovetail with the main idea of the book. So the first two-thirds is all about creating this better culture that's inspiring, supportive, and encouraging. Then the last part, last third of the book, is some details that if you miss these details, you're never going to be able to create that thing the first two-thirds of the book talked about. And one of those is the elephant in the room. We have to talk about things and not ignore things and not just act like they don't bother us or act like they do, but we still don't want to talk. We can't do that. I thought about today, and someday I'm going to do this. Maybe it'll be on the website. I'm going to talk about how to resign or how not to resign because I have gotten 3 or 4 resignations this year. And a lot of times the resignation came as a point to have a conversation versus just having the conversation. And then if that conversation doesn't go well and the follow-up conversation doesn't go well, then give your resignation if you need to. But sometimes we just don't know how to do that. And so I thought about that, but these couple sentences deal a little bit with it. We don't want to. Unhealthy teams never talk about the elephant in the room. The refusal to talk about the issue is a bigger deal than the issue themselves. And we should talk earlier, not later. One of the points he makes in the book is if a lot of times pastors and other people, they wait until they're so angry and then they talk. And then they don't talk well when they do that. I don't know if you guys ever do that in your marriages or your parenting. I might have done that once or twice, maybe. I don't know. Pretty sure I did. Leading people is very difficult, and even the best leaders aren't always successful. Just look at Jesus. You know, he makes that statement that don't be quite so hard on yourself and be a lot more supportive of one another, because leading is difficult. And Jesus was the Son of God, the perfect one, and he couldn't get Judas to follow very well, you know. He just couldn't quite get him to get in line, you know. And Peter's had a few issues, and I mean, one day the crowds were all, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," and the next day the crowds were, "Crucify him, we want Barabbas," you know. And so Jesus had his days of not doing so well as leader also. And it wasn't him, it was just a difficult task, and it was parts of the other parts of the environment. And sometimes it's that way for us too. Every growing organization has to make friends with an ally called chaos. When I read that, I just go to Maxwell Smart, you know, and chaos and the cone of silence. I just go to that's my generation, though. I thought that was always a good name for an evil group trying to take over the world. But this says chaos is a good thing, and God uses it, and you need to get comfortable with it. So you have to make friends with an odd ally called chaos. And we hate that. I hate it. I really hate it. My C part of my personality hates chaos. C part of my personality hates things that aren't in order, done, finished, checked off. It really does. So I have problems with chaos. Usually I feel like if chaos is around, a lot of things are wrong. But it says if you're growing and if you're going to grow, you better get used to chaos because it's just going to happen. You're adventurous. You're trying new things. You're stretching yourself. You're trying to be full of faith and follow the will of God. You're believing God to fill in gaps, and all of that creates chaos. You're making changes, and there's strategies behind it, and there's just a lot of chaos. It says, in the crucible of chaos, God forms our character, creates a new culture, and determines our destiny. And then my response to that was, bummer. I hate chaos. I want everything to be in order, smooth, and but God says, and this author definitely says, in the crucible of chaos, your character is formed, you can create a whole new culture, and your destiny is determined on how you handle that. Three challenges to dealing with chaos are redefining failure, creating a sense of urgency to take advantage of opportunities, and managing conflict. So those three challenges are pretty interesting. Redefining failure. Failure isn't final, it isn't futile, it isn't even that you've done something wrong. It's just that you're doing things different, you're doing things new, you're on a learning curve to improve things. And failures are stepping stones to a better future. And if we can view it that way, we can be much more supportive of one another on those days when we're failing. And we can, he has a whole bunch of a chapter on that. The next one is creating a sense of urgency to take advantage of opportunities. And he does about half a chapter on this one. He talks about the growth curve of an organization. We've talked about it before in some other leadership meetings we've had. When you start something, it creates this curve. And before the curve tops out, they call this point A, on the backside of that curve when it's still on its way up. And if you'll make changes at point A before you feel like you need to, and before the people following you feel like you need to, If you can make changes at point A, you can cause that curve to just keep going up. But if you wait till you go over the hill and down the other side to point B is, oh no, something's really wrong, we better change something. If you wait to point B to make changes, you've got a lot harder work, and you're going to have this roller coaster. You may not ever get it back. It may dive on you. And so when I'm looking at that, I'm going, okay, so the chaos part is you're climbing, things are going good, and it's time to make changes before you plateau. See, we want to start making changes after we plateau or after we decline. But he says, no, you need to take advantage of the opportunities of your momentum and continue to make changes and continue to keep climbing. And that is contrary to our normal logic. It is really contrary. And you want to talk about grumbling in a congregation when you start making changes at those points and people don't understand that concept. They think you're loony toony. And then the last one is managing conflict. Challenges to chaos, because there is conflict. How do you manage conflict? We walked through the Crucial Conversations book. There's just so much great information in that book on how to deal in difficult conversations. And then we did couples communication last winter, and a lot of great information on that, using the wheel and the listening side of the wheel and the talking side of the wheel. So we've done a few things to try to help us with managing conflict and having those difficult conversations. And those are things you have to do in the middle of chaos. The next point, options for opening the system to fresh ideas are almost endless. So you need a continual flow of fresh ideas in order to make those changes at point A instead of wait till you're in panic mode at point B. So you need a continual flow of those fresh ideas. And options to create those are endless. Leadership teams have used consultants, seminars, and books to challenge their thinking and their strategies. New hires can bring a fresh perspective to a team and shake up the old culture in a healthy way. Almost anything can help if the leader invites new thinking to challenge the status quo. And you guys all know that I am pro new thinking to challenge the status quo. Usually I am. The goal isn't to throw everything out the window and start over every few months, but to be always open to new ideas and fresh ways of fulfilling the vision that God has given the church. So we always need fresh ideas coming into our church, into our leadership, into our organization. We always need fresh ideas. That's why we should go to seminars. That's why we should go to conferences. That's why we should read books and listen to podcasts. And we should expose ourselves to what is God doing around the world? What are successful churches doing that we're not doing? Not everything works for us. Dave Minton says it this way, if my bullet fits your gun, use it. You know, and I've looked at a lot of bullets that didn't fit our gun. I'm going, that's cool, but it doesn't fit our gun. That's a cool idea, but I don't think God wants us to do that here. But I have walked away with a pocket full of ammunition several times of that will fit our gun, and that is something God's doing in our generation, and we can get on board with that. Early, be an early adopter instead of a late adopter. He has a whole bunch of, maybe an entire chapter about early adopters and late adopters and never adopters. You know, there's five layers of that. I forget what they are. Early adopters, people that wait to see if everyone else is getting on board, they'll get on board. Late adopters, they'll celebrate you when you have the ribbon cutting, you know. And then the never adopters, they're going to leave the church and be mad because they never are going to like the change, or what happened. The next one there, one great team member, I love this part. One great team member has the impact of multiple mediocre team members, and in some cases, that should be the ratio instead of the ration, the ratio was as high as 8-1. I thought, wow, that's awesome that one great team member can impact the church so positively in kind of an 8-to-1 ratio. Then my comment there is I think many of you are that good too. I think a lot of you are 8-to-1 over a mediocre person, and your level of commitment and your level of work and your effort, I really do. So thank you for that. I feel like we have a great team. Embracing the chaos of change. An individual may embrace or resist change for any number of reasons. A simple preference, a core value, peer pressure, groupthink, or a need to defend staked-out turf. So those are reasons some people would resist or adopt the chaos of change. Some people just don't prefer it. Other people have a core value that's adverse to that. Other people have family and relatives and neighbors and peers that would pressure them to not like that or to like it, one or the other. Groupthink, they could be a part of a group that expresses one thing and feels one way. Or they have some staked out turf that they're defending that change would affect. The more important factors that shape team members' responses are, and this was interesting to me when I read this, I'm going, the way the change is presented. So sometimes it's not the change itself, it's the way it's presented or not presented, sometimes in our case. The level of respect for the person who presents it. And he gives several examples of, if Susie presents it, I'm all in. But if Bill presents it, I don't like Bill or nothing he ever stands for, and I'm just automatically against it if Bill presents it, you know. I don't think we have that issue here. But the person who presents it, the rate of change. So sometimes the change is a little fast for them or a little slow for them. I've got people on both ends of the spectrum that bend my ear, you know. I'm way too slow for some people, and I'm way too fast for others. I'm not sure how God thinks about it. And the clarity for the team member's role in the process of change. So what is my role in this process of change? If it's clear, if I know what to expect, then I am a lot more likely to adopt it and go along with it. If it's cloudy and fuzzy, I'm not going to be so excited about it for a while until I get it clarified. Chaos, no matter what the cause might be, is a test that shows what people and organizations are really made of. It's experiencing times of chaos is like squeezing a sponge. Whatever was lurking there comes out. But seasons of change are only tragic if leaders fail to take advantage of them. If we respond with insight, courage, and hope, they become catalysts for incredible growth for the church and for each person on the team. So chaos and difficulties aren't always bad. In fact, we probably are all going to have to get to the point to where we like a little chaos. And if we don't have a little, we wonder what's wrong. What's going on? Yeah, praise the Lord. We've had plenty of chaos the last few weeks. That's okay. We created it. The next chapter is on changing vehicles. I love his illustration here. If I wanted to travel to London from my home in Atlanta, it wouldn't matter if I had a Lamborghini or a Rolls Royce. A car would not get me to Piccadilly. No amount of wishing or claiming promises will make the car a suitable vehicle to reach the destination I desire. If London is my vision, I have to abandon the vehicle I'm using and find another vehicle to get me there. That's tough for me some days. Some days that is tough for me to go, I love this vehicle. This is one of my favorite vehicles. I'm really comfortable in this vehicle. It's my favorite color. It has all my favorite options. I have lots of memories in this vehicle. And now you ask me to abandon this vehicle because I have to get on an airplane or a ship to take me across the ocean to London? Bummer. And sometimes the vision God gives us, he says, Kelly, your car is never going to get you there. Your favorite vehicle, That really helped me. You guys heard me make the phrase, the statements, you know, that I'm doing things I hate, teaching things I hate, singing things I hate, playing music that I hate to get results that I love. And I finally realized that God just asked me to get in a different vehicle because the old vehicle would never get the job done. Just wouldn't do it. So I'm going, okay, God. A Ford airplane? Yeah, that'd be cool. That was the Chevy. They made a tailgate out of it and put a... They took the tailgate and made a bench out of it. Pat sent me a picture on Facebook about that. Oh. That's a good use for a Chevy right there, a park bench. Yeah. If London is my vision, I have to abandon the vehicle I'm using and find another vehicle to get me there. And you want to talk about opposition. When you abandon the loved vehicle and get in the vehicle that has the potential to get you to the destination, you can have a ton of opposition, a ton of misunderstanding at those points. We shouldn't scale back our vision to match our capabilities. I kind of wanted to go to London, felt like I was supposed to go to London, but my car won't get me to London, so I'm just going to Atlantic City. That's as far as I'm going. That's it. You shouldn't scale back the vision to match your capabilities. The only reasonable thing is to change your vehicle. Many churches have been doing the same thing so long they don't even know that other vehicles exist. I thought that was an interesting phrase, and I wonder sometimes if I'm in that category. Some days I think I'm contemporary. Some days I think I am. But when I see what other churches are doing and what success they're having and how they're having success, and I'm thinking about Kamei, I'm going, we don't have an international airport. I don't think that vehicle can land here. I don't think that's going to work here. I don't think the 747 is going to manage the Kamei airport, you know. So I'll have to settle for a Learjet, a little smaller version or something like that. Sometimes I wonder, do I even know the vehicle that currently exists that will get me where I have to go for God? It'll get the life center where we have to be. Some days I don't think I even know that vehicle yet. I don't even know it exists yet. There's a huge difference between the dining area of a fine restaurant and the kitchen. Some of you will remember this from T.D. Jakes' CD we passed around the church, and probably a lot of you listened to it, and he talked about there's a whole big difference between the dining room and the kitchen, and some people love the dining room of the church, and when they get in the kitchen, they're surprised by the pressure and the stress and the expectations and the language and the mess that's in the kitchen. A few inches beyond the idyllic setting of the dining room, where there's a cloth tablecloth, soft music, gentle lighting, and courteous service, is a very different environment. People are running around, cooking, preparing plates, fussing with each other. Making a delicious entree is a messy process. Leading a church isn't much different from being a chef in a busy, chaotic kitchen. I think sometimes you just need to keep remembering that, especially if we're on leadership teams. You have to keep remembering that. The Chinese characters that form the word crisis is a combination of danger and opportunity. I think most of us have probably heard that before. So a crisis maybe has some danger in it, but there's also a ton of opportunity. I don't always see the opportunity. I don't know about you. When I'm facing a crisis, it's like, God, may this cup pass from me, you know? And I don't pray the last part. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. I'm just praying, may this cup pass from me. That's my prayer. But God says, along with that danger is an opportunity. Along with that conflict is an opportunity for closer relationships. Along with that misunderstanding is an opportunity to understand better. Along with that whatever, whatever is an opportunity. It's not just a danger and it's not just a crisis. And we should be able to see things as an opportunity. Every crisis calls us to face danger, but we need to redefine it as an opportunity. In healthy churches, this is how he ends the book. In healthy churches, where skilled, caring leaders communicate often and well with their teams and value their input, risks are minimized because people feel affirmed, have clear roles and goals, and don't become embroiled in turf wars. I thought that's the inspiring culture that God wants in his churches right there. Four needs: clarity, 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 clarity. Today I'm writing this and I'm finishing up the notes and I've started asking myself a question every once in a while. What am I not communicating that I need to communicate? What am I not telling to who that I need to tell them? And I need to ask myself that question about 20 times a day and then act on the next thoughts that are there. Clarity. A leader to model steady emotions, avoiding extreme highs and lows. Four needs: clarity, and leaders who provide those steady emotions, avoiding extreme highs or lows. That's challenging sometimes. That's challenging. I can't be extremely high and then extremely low. What does the Bible say about a double-minded man? Unstable in all of his ways. And let not that man think he shall receive anything from the Lord. And sometimes we are that person. Sometimes we're the person of charge, let's go do it, God. And then a couple days later, it's like gloom, despair, and agony on me. Nobody loves me. I don't think this will ever work. And we have to be able to guard our emotions a little better than that. That's not always easy at all. Take actions after decisions are made and the new direction is set. He talks a lot in this book about one part of culture that is really difficult for people is you keep talking about it, but you never get to do it. You never do it. You never finalize, let's do it. Who's going to do it? When are we going to do it? How are we going to do it? And just nail all that stuff down. He's got a form in the back of the book that he suggests that we use when we're looking at a project or looking at a task, and let's just organize it and work it. And so take action after decisions are made and new direction is set. And then the last one is a need for security in unsettling times. We just need to know that we're secure. We need to know that I may be unsettled, but at least half of the team's secure. At least half of the team's ready to go. At least half of the team is healthy and encouraged, and we're going to ride them for a while I'm not doing so well. And then when they're doing better, or when they have a bad day or a bad season, they can ride me for a while. When they're not doing so well, I'll carry the heavier load. And so feeling security in unsettling times. Any questions, comments? You have about 4 minutes. Jewel.
I just want to thank you for keeping it within the hour and moving along and providing information.
You're welcome.
I just have a question.
A question.
The survey we're supposed to fill out, is it a... like based on the whole church, or is it based on our individual departments?
I haven't seen it yet. I think it's going to be based on the culture of the in church. Yeah. Yeah, I'm scared. Yes, it will be your experience in the church, your experience as leaders, and whatever. They're going to ask questions about those seven categories that aren't that we named in the notes. That's what they're going to be asking questions about.
It says vocabulary defines culture. Explain that.
The words we use tell a lot more than anything else. If we, like, we use words of outsiders. We had some outsiders come to church the other day. If you use that word versus guests, that vocabulary would say a lot about how you really feel and what the culture really is. So the words we use and how we use them really are definitions of our culture more than our mission statement or vision statement or what we say behind the pulpit or in public. And we probably don't even notice them, yeah. Yeah. I've changed a lot of my vocabulary over the years. Who's got it?
I think it makes me feel better that chaos is a good thing. Because I have a lot of chaos in some of the things that I'm doing right now, which I know is just a process, but I always feel like I'm behind and never getting it all done, and there's always some new change and another project, and I don't have the last project finished, and so at least it's a good thing. I just have to retrain my thinking to that.
Yay! Anybody else? No? Well, thanks for coming tonight. If you have any questions that pop up, one of the other things about in the book was saying, I'm not going to talk about that. If you have any other things that pop up, you could just ask me questions. I love to answer questions. God bless you guys. Have a great night.